All right, here we go.
Three, two.
This is Joshua David Bellin, author of the young adult science fiction adventure Survival Colony 9, and you're listening to Comic Pop Library.
Whatever you do, I'll do it too. Show me everything and tell me how. You don't mean something and yet nothing to me. Oh, I can see there's so much to learn. It's all so close and yet so far. I see myself as people see me. Oh, I just know there's something bigger out there.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode of Comic Pop Visits, brought to you by Comic Pop Library. I'm Richard, along with
Jacob
and Jonathan.
And today we are visiting with the author William Schlichter. He is the author of No Room in Hell, The Good, the Bad, and the Undead. That's the podcast that we reviewed on one of his books. But he also has a couple of others. Enter the Sandman, which is the first book of his Silver Dragon Chronicles, and The Dark Side as well, which is coming out in 2017. So, William, thank you for coming on with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And just also looking at some of your bios, you've done some script writing as well, it says. So we probably will get into that a little bit with you, see how that entails. But for the most part, we're going to talk about the books that you've written. And you've been in the teaching industry for quite a while, but you said you decided to go back to writing. What got that bug that bit you to make you go back to writing?
Well, I never really quit. I've always written, but my daughters finally became adults, and it's like Dad can focus on Dad again.
Okay, I know that feeling. We're kind of there.
But I went back a couple years ago, and I quit teaching for a couple years to get my master's degree, and in theater. Took some screenwriting courses and so won a couple awards for some of the scripts I wrote, and I thought, well, you know what, now's the time to just to jump. Okay. And go for it.
And the two you're mentioning is you in 2013 you got a Broadcast Education Association National Festival of Media Arts for the spec script for The Walking Dead for an episode. So that's kind of cool. That's kind of cool.
Oh, it was amazing. Yeah, I got to go to Vegas and receive my award. I wrote an episode. It was right before they got to the prison. And I called it What Money Can't Buy, and they find a survivor, a millionaire or a billionaire, who had just used all his money to make his life perfect in the zombie apocalypse, and wouldn't share any of his supplies with the group, and that didn't sit too well with Rick.
Cool.
So, but it took place, and I just really, really remotivated me to write again. And then I'd done all the research, and I just loved it. And then I thought, well, I'm going to use all that stuff and then write a zombie book and maybe fix some of the problems in The Walking Dead.
Okay, so that's how I'm getting caught here. That's how No Room in Hell came about then. Okay, I see. And that came out, like I said, in 2016. And you were kind enough to send us a digital copy from your publisher. So thank you very much for doing that. It is appreciated.
Well, for reviewing it, I appreciate that.
One of the things with the sci-fi novel and the horror novel, do you kind of take the same approach where it's fast and hard and in your face, or is the sci-fi a little bit tamer in tone?
When I go to shows and I try to talk about my book to people, I always kind of say I think the zombie novel's definitely for 17 and up, and I think the sci-fi novel's, you can be about 13 and up to read it. But it has a much stronger female lead character, and not quite as gritty. It is a little bit dark. I kind of describe it as a Freddy Krueger encounters, or Buck Rogers encounters Freddy Krueger. But it's not the same level of intensity as the zombie novel at all. I mean, I don't want them to be looked at as, oh, well, this is almost the same book or same character. I mean, there's some authors that always seem to write the same character, or actors who always play the same character. And I wanted something totally different.
So is Silver Dragon more of a sci-fi horror then, or pure sci-fi?
It's more sci-fi fantasy to introduce creatures that seep in from another reality, and they'll play with your thoughts and your brains, kind of on a nightmarish level, but nowhere near what we're in the No Room in Hell.
Okay. It's almost like a Hellraiser aspect.
Right.
A little bit. Like I said, I see them getting in there and they play with their minds and make them think that things are happening or try to control their thoughts. And of course, the creatures are a myth. People don't believe they exist. So, of course, you're crazy when you talk about them and all that. But it's all in the backdrop of the war they're trying to prevent in this universe. And it has some rich and some diversity. I'm actually I'm always working on something. But I'd like to do a kind of a sidequel comic book and expand the universe a little bit as well with that Silver Dragon. But I've worked on that forever. And that's been like kind of my whole envision of what I wanted to write was that particular story.
Okay.
How do you, like, differentiate your characters? I mean, like, how do you keep them separated from, you know, not having similar traits to the other one?
No, any of your characters, I create a backstory. I'll write little side pieces that never make it into the book. I give them their own personalities. Sometimes they tell me what they want to do, and there's no arguing with them.
So do you kind of keep a Bible or a file?
Oh, the Silver Dragon story, I have about a 60-page document that, would make a really cool wiki one day that's full of spoilers and details down to eye color, to parents. Some of them I've decided how they're going to die, whether or not that happens, but I've written it. Sometimes I just get the character just kind of speaks to me, and I'll write a little story that may never make it into a book, but it just really helps to develop them further. But yeah, I keep lots of notes. I have some big old 3-foot by 3-foot bulletin boards where I stick notes and map things out and outline and keep track of this, that, and the other thing, not only just for continuity, but for myself, so I don't forget that I've decided this or that, or I want this to happen to them.
You say that the characters will speak to you, but you also say that you outline things, so you kind of have the general idea on where you want your Silver Dragon Chronicles to go and how many books you want it to be and how it's going to end, or do you just, or is it kind of as you outline the next book is that how you kind of expand your Bible or your board?
Well, a little bit of both. I've worked on my Silver Dragon stories forever. I actually kind of have 7 books or enough written to fill 7 books up. I've revisited the beginning stories and polished them and changed some things. So some of those notes are easier to add. When I write a story, usually I'll write the ending first. And that way I kind of know where I'm going to go. But yeah, I have ideas of things that I want certain things to happen with a character. Amy has a sister, and I have plans for this sister in the story, and I've known that forever, and I don't know at what point I'm ever going to get to that storyline, but I know that's where it's heading. Other things I plan out greatly, and there's not a typo in the first book that people will probably think is a typo, because a character is called by the wrong military rank, but it's to set up a much later storyline. It's one of those little things that you go, wow, because I like that. I like things that are well set up and you get paid off later instead of some of my favorite sci-fi shows are written by the seat of their pants. And if they'd have planned them a little better, their stories would make a lot more sense.
Right.
So, and you deal with, there's some confusion. The Sandmen, when they come in the second novel, which is out February 28th, it seems like what they're doing makes no sense, but I have totally plotted out. Later, when that comes to fruition, it's going to go, oh, okay, I get it. And I like that. I like that in a story. So, as they say, you know, when you can't find the stories you want to read, you write them yourself.
Exactly, and especially like as I read, I like the idea that the author is maybe not necessarily smarter than I am, but has definitely, you know, they put little pieces in one book and then they reference it like maybe 2 books later, and you're like, oh, they've really been thinking about this for a while. It's not something that they just, oh yeah, I can tie this together neatly, and so I'm going to now.
Yeah, I have that plotted out at least for 7. 7 of the Silver Dragon books.
Okay.
That I know what's going to happen. And then I still have some other things I want to finish up with some of the characters, and who knows when that'll come out. But they're searching. Once the Sandmen are released in the reality, they discover a way to stop them, but they have to kind of piece together this orb that'll tell them how to do it. The MacGuffin of the story, every so many books they'll find a chunk of it, but I only have X amount of pieces mapped out of where they're going to find them, so who knows where the others are. But I have an end game in mind for a couple different characters which will propel those plots. But yeah, sometimes things, but you never know. I mean, sometimes a glorious death must come, or somebody leaves, or I had one character in this sequel to No Room in Hell, which will be out May 19th. There was a character that was on the side of the road that literally is now taking over one of the groups in the book. She was kind of a stop and rob character. We're going to take her stuff, and now she wants to be, you know, queen of the world. I was like, I had no plans for that. It was just, it happened.
Right.
Okay. And the title, working title for that, I don't know if it's a concrete title, but that's 400 Miles to Graceland.
That is the title. I love that title. I know my zombie book titles are a little bit campy and the stories are not, but I think they're fun. I like that. You know, I like that to be a little bit. They're not comedies. They are very serious and very dark. But I also would like to think that I start off with them being very dark, and maybe there'll be not a happy ending. It's a zombie world. You can't have a happy ending, but maybe the people can get to a better place, which is something we don't see very often in a lot of zombie books. And I do want to write 5 of those, and I do have them. I have a rough map of the storyline with the 5. With the 5 books and what's going to happen with a couple of characters. Because I like to see growth. Back to the Silver Dragon Chronicles, there's a princess character, and she's a princess. I mean, she barely allowed to comb her own hair, princess. And I want her to go from that to become a much greater character in the story, and I don't think you can do that in one book.
Okay.
And I think it'll be much more satisfying after 3 or 4 books as she grows in the story.
Right. No, I agree. I mean, because I think if you took her from can't comb her own hair to, you know, maybe badass warrior princess, I don't know what you have planned for, but in one book you almost end up with like a Rey from Force Awakens, where nothing can go wrong for her, and it makes her a slightly less believable character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I think sometimes films have a tendency to rush that, and that's sometimes dissatisfying, even though she's a great character. I mean, a great, strong female character, and highly positive. I can't wait to see what they do with her in the next film. But yeah, I want some of these story things to go on and on and on, which sort of breaks up the hero journey idea. But I mean, if it's a much longer story, these characters are going to develop. Dexter was the worst offender. They reset him at the end of at the beginning of each season. It's like everything we've accomplished, he goes back to zero. I was like, what happened?
Exactly.
I only watched the first season of that one,
if you ever get caught up, you can stop after season 4, because it kind of...
I was just going to say that.
I mean, if you have nothing better to do, then yeah, you can watch 5 through 8, but at the end, but you're not going to miss anything by stopping at the end of season 4.
Cool.
Yeah, 7 and 8, it was over at 6, it was okay.
It was... like I was just telling Jonathan before we started, it was literally Arthur Fonzarelli going up and jumping over the shark. It's kind of how it felt to me.
Yeah. Okay.
So.
I haven't even read the book, so I don't know.
You can reset some elements of a person, but I think a reader really likes that growth, and they want it to stay with the character, so... You know, some people might complain, oh, she's a princess and women should be this, and it's science fiction where women are by far equal and superior to male characters. No, there's still places out there where they're not, and they need to grow.
To jump to the No Room in Hell, you did a little bit of a unique thing with your lead character, or one of your lead characters, and that is the man in the duster. You did not name him until the very end. How did that play about, and how did that decision come about?
Well, I really kind of liked the, Clint Eastwood in the spaghetti westerns, the man with no name, the hero type character, and I was a challenge to myself. I wanted to see if I could write this story where we just didn't call this guy John or Bill or George. I just really wanted to play with that. And there were some sections that got a little bit challenging to write, so it was clear who was doing what. And I just kind of wanted this kind of everyman mythical character that's out there. He's intelligent, because that's something we don't see in a lot of zombie stories. It's like, how are these people still alive? And I just something I wanted to play with. And yes, he is more the main character of the series. And he's not, well, in the second one, it's going to be interesting, because he's not going to be able to be Superman forever.
Okay.
He wasn't either. I mean, he's got a bad limp, which actually perpetuates his ability to just have to shoot these things.
Right.
Can't run away. You know, I mean, so it's like, okay, you've got to survive. He's not like wholly handicapped, but he can't really run. So he's going to have to survive other ways. As far as that goes. But yeah, it was something I wrote. I wanted to challenge myself and see what happened. And I kind of like that idea, that mystery of this guy that's in this world, trying to save and help people and maybe build a little bit of a society.
It definitely made a challenge for the back of the book when you're trying to discuss what the book's about.
yes, it is. But you don't want to give away. And then a lot of people that have read it, I was like, who's your favorite character? So the one you didn't give a name to. And actually, some people miss the name at the end.
Yeah, I was trying to think in my brain if I could. I wanted to say, but I don't think that's right.
Well, that's his last name.
Okay. I must have missed the first name then.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll just call him the Pale Rider. That way,
there you go.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, he is pretty that much. Kind of mythical figure. He's he becomes a gunslinger. I don't think he was born that way, and he is intelligent, and he's trying to survive and help people. And I don't think it's just girls in that story that are damsels in distress. It's almost just about everybody.
Right. Well, you took the apocalyptic scene. And I'm thinking of Deathlands. I don't know if you remember that title by, God, I can't remember the author now. But anyway, it's a Deathlands series. It's a men's adventure as well. But it's, you know, it's like a Mac Bolan Executioner men's adventure. But yours takes the apocalyptic to a very darker place than what most do. And I'm assuming that was intentional, and to make it probably feel more of what would probably actually happen if it did happen in our society.
Well, I think we're about three happy meals away from total chaos, or lacking three happy meals. We're about total chaos. Yes, I wanted it to be dark. I actually, in my education background, my first teaching job was in corrections in prison, so I met some very interesting people. So I've seen maybe some darker sides of some things, but I just think people will just do whatever to survive, and hopefully the right people come together to try to rebuild society. We would hope. I also just from screenwriting, a lot of times they said that they liked, if you were trying to pursue that as a career, sometimes they like to see if you can write dark, and I thought, well, I'm going to try this story and see how dark I can get. And my sister read it and told me that, she goes, I've read worse. And I'm like,
oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, that's
really?
What I thought. I was like, what are you reading?
Golly. Okay. Because the opening scene is kind of like, wow, that's just a punch in the gut and an uppercut at the same time. It's like, whoa. But okay. What did she read that was worse than that? I'm kind of curious now.
I didn't ask. Believe it or not, we were a nice, normal family growing up. Family. It's like, wow. So,
and we're mentioning Dexter, so okay.
Yeah.
What was the family life like? I don't know.
My screenplay that I had written that has been a finalist in several script competitions follows a serial killer. So, of course, all that research I put into being accurate was kind of in my brain when I started this story, which is why one of the characters is chasing down a serial killer, because I feel like a lot of zombie stories forget the rest of the world. I mean, it has problems. I mean, global warming didn't go away just because the zombies happened, or global climate change. There's still natural disasters. I mean, would a nuclear plant melt down, or would it shut? You know, I mean, all these things would happen. And I just thought, well, a serial killer would almost thrive in that type of environment.
Right. True.
But what would happen? You know, here's a cop. He couldn't chase the guy down because it was his daughter who was killed. He has to be removed from the case. And now he tries for a while to be a cop after the world has fallen apart, and just decides, you know what, I don't need a search warrant, I'm going to go find this guy that killed my kid.
It's the Wild West again, by golly.
It kind of is, and it's kind of interesting. And the other thing, a lot of, unless it's a military-centered zombie story, it's like, where'd the military go?
Right.
Mm-hmm. True.
And I thought, well, so then we follow Colonel Travis, which I did pick intentionally, because that's the Alamo. But
I noticed you picked Fort Leonard. Is that
Fort Leonard Wood? Yeah, I used to live. I visited the base a couple times. I used to live in that area for several years. I've been on base, and I just thought that's the other thing. A lot of zombie stories don't take place in the Midwest.
Right.
It's like it's Los Angeles or New York. I mean, I'm never going to Paris. Every time the aliens invade, the city's blown apart. I mean,
right. True.
And so I was just like, I wanted to explore some areas, and I've gotten some compliments on that from people who've read it. It's like, you know, I know this place, or I know that place, or I've been here, and I like that too. I mean, I've seen Rodeo Drive on the TV, but it doesn't mean a lot when zombies aren't coming down there. There was a book years ago, and I don't remember the author, but it was called 8.4, and it was about an earthquake in the Midwest, the New Madrid Fault going off, and he described areas of a place that I drove every day, and I was like, if that doesn't add terror to what you're reading and makes it more real for people, it's, you know, it feels more real than a mythical land where we're not even sure where our characters are.
And I know... I mean,
we play a little bit with mileage, maybe, you know, maybe they do get someplace a little faster or a little slower, but I mean, you know, speed of plots.
True. And I remember reading, I think it was a Lincoln Child novel and Douglas Preston, the Pendergast novels, and there was Still Life with Crows, I believe, and it took place in Kansas.
Yeah.
And I think they made up the town, but everything around it was actually there. So they were having, of all places, you know, they were saying there was an FBI field office in Garden City, which I don't know if there is or not, but I kind of doubt it because it's not that big. But it was just kind of neat to hear Garden City and Dodge City and some of those places in a novel. So,
oh yeah,
I can understand that.
Mark Twain and Huckleberry Finn, the only city he makes up is St. Petersburg, which is Hannibal, and every place else they visit is a real city. Yeah. It's like, why did you change the name of Hannibal as opposed to that? I kind of do that too, though. I change the name of my small town, but I still describe all the other places right around it. I mean, there's only one logical place it could be. I guess that's kind of your kind of your take on the town. Maybe it's not like that, or it is like that. I don't know. So it's... Sometimes it's just something writers do, because I'm not sure we're exactly normal.
You've been hitting the convention circuit, and how's that been going? And that's kind of where I discovered you at, and like I said,
yeah,
I was limited.
I met you at my first, that was the first one I did.
Okay.
In Smallville, Kansas, and I tell you what, no bones about it, that is an amazing con. And I saw the guests, I'm going to be back this year. Should have all four books available, and then I'll have a fifth one that's a standalone for people that don't like to read series, but I don't know if that'll be ready or not. That is actually going to be a thriller serial killer novel. Like I said, you spend all those hours doing that research, it's like there's so many stories there. It's a great con, and it's growing. The guest list is going like crazy, and it's still, I guess, kind of a medium-sized con, so it's great. You get to do things and meet people, and you're not standing in line forever. Right. I just got back this weekend. I just got back from Branson, Missouri, and Vision Con. Great con, a lot of fun. Another one that's kind of small. 3 weeks from now, I'm going to do one at Stealth Con in Warrensburg, Missouri. And then after that, there's Lebanon MegaCon on the other side of Springfield. And then I'm gonna try one in Indiana, because it's spring break and I don't have to take days off work. And I'm also going to do a couple Walker Stalker cons, and it's just like, you know, it's great to get out there and meet people and talk to them about books. And you know, a lot of writers come, and I did this too before I got published. I would go talk to writers at their booths, like, how'd you get published, how do you do this, how do you do that. It's a great way to connect with people. I love to watch all the cosplayers. I mean, I spend more time chasing down people for pictures than I should be sitting at my table. it's just so much fun to be out there and to talk with people and especially about the craft. I mean, I teach creative writing, I teach composition, but you know, some of those students are there because they're there. those people that come to your table want to talk about your book or want to talk about writing. I mean, that's what they want to do, or that's what they're so interested in. It's so great to meet those kind of people, and they should. They should write. I had one little 10-year-old boy at a con. He comes up and he tells me, he says, you need to write a story, and you need to do this and do this and do this and do this. And I looked at the little 10-year-old boy, and I looked at the kid, and I said, no. I said, you need to go write that story. That's your story, kid. And he runs off. And half an hour later, he comes back, and he's just like, thank you so much for encouraging me. I am going to do that. And I thought, but that was great. I mean, that was so good. And he should, you know. I mean, get out there and do it and try. I mean, I kind of feel like if I get out there and I fail, at least I failed trying to do something I've always wanted to do my whole life. So, but I don't think I'm failing. I think I'm doing great. I think it's wonderful. It's you know, it's doing so much better than I thought.
Cool.
You know, so, sometimes because, I mean, writers always judge themselves. They write something and they go, oh, my God, who's going to read this crap? But they don't. They love it, you know? I mean, so.
Sounds about right with me. I'm working on a couple of novels myself. But I was just wondering, how did you find your publisher? I mean, what steps did you have to take?
Well, I had spent years collecting rejection letters from the major publishing houses. And then after I got my, I won those script, when I went back and got my master's and got those a couple of recognitions with my script writing, and I won the, took third place in the Broadcaster Association, and then I placed a lot of the major script contests for feature films. I mean, you're either the winner or you're a finalist. There was no ranking. And one of them had, I made it to quarterfinals, but there were 4,500 entries. To be 269 out of 4,500 was like, wow. So I, with that recognition, I used that. I'd met another author that went through a small press, and I got in contact with them, and they were really interested in what I was doing. And then they just re-released The Invisible Man, H.G. Wells' The Invisible Man, and I wrote the foreword for them.
So. Right. I saw that on your bio as well. I said, when Jacob and I were talking about that earlier, I said, that's kind of cool to be able to do that for a classic.
Yeah, that was great. I was just like, wow. I mean, total fantasy would be to be one for like War of the Worlds, but I mean, still, it's H.G. Wells to ask me to do a foreword was like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, it was wonderful and a lot of fun. And you know, the small presses, I think, are the way to go. You get some support, you get some quality people working on it, and I go to a lot of these cons, and a lot of the other authors there are small press publishers, and I'm reading their books, and I'm like, this is amazing. Why is this not being peddled instead of, say, you know, Sparkly Vampires? It's like, why are these people not, you know, I mean, their stories are great. It's just like, how, I mean, you know, sometimes it is when an agent or a publisher, you know, rolls over and decides, oh, the story sounds good. I mean, J.K. Rowling, you know, the publisher took the final person that gave her the shot, took the book home and threw it at his kid and said, what do you think? And she didn't come down for like 2 days. You know,
that
so.
Contact high.
You know, imagine being that daughter that got to read Harry at 10 years old, got to read Harry Potter before it was Harry Potter, you know.
With your writing and going to the conventions and doing this foreword, when you go back to your students and you relay this kind of things to them, does that kind of get their juices flowing even when you're going back to your students that you're teaching?
Oh, yeah. Have you watched the Netflix Daredevil series?
I don't have Netflix.
Yes.
Jacob has.
Okay, all right. So season 2, I think it's episode 5, the scene in the rain. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Okay, great scene. Probably one of the best love sex scenes I've ever seen captured on film, and there's no sex. It's a brilliant romantic moment. And I show that little 4 or 5 minute clip to my creative writing students, and they love it. Well, I went to a con, I met Charlie Cox, and I told him that as he was signing my autograph, and he sat there and talked to me for like 7 minutes about it, and he thought that was the coolest thing, that I was using that scene in my class to teach kids how to write this scene that was so incredibly and so well done. And he said it was filmed exactly the way it was scripted, and I just thought that was so amazing. So that was just like this moment. I mean, I thought it was an amazing scene, and he's like, you're teaching that to your students, and he thought that was incredible. and the kids love it. My high school kids think it's great. They are, I think they're a little more attentive they like to hear about those kind of things and what you see and what you do. And you know, I'm by no means a writing expert, and I'll show them editing pages from my editor that, you know, she's taken, the quote unquote red pen to it. And, you know, it's like, I'm not perfect either, guys. You got to keep writing this stuff. You got to keep working at it. And I'll share that with them. And I think that encourages them too, because I think sometimes they think it's just got to be written and it's perfect. And it's not. I mean, you work on it forever. I worked on the Silver Dragon, you know, I wrote the first draft sometime in high school. And then I worked on it for 20 years until finally it got to, you know, I was able to get it published. I'd send it off, collect rejection letters. I'd set it on a shelf. I'd write another story. I'd rework it and keep working it until you're done. It'll happen if you keep working at it. And that's what I give to my students. And I get now with Facebook, you run into more of them, and they're like, well, thank you for being so encouraging. And it's like, you know, I just, you know, you just try to do that for them.
Right. Well, and that's the thing that I keep, you know, in the back of my mind. And, you know, several of my friends do a lot of writing. They write more like little shorts and little scripts, and they're always so discouraged when their first draft isn't that great. But if I remember right, it was Hemingway that said the first draft is always crap.
Yes, that is the quote I do put on the board, except I have to censor it because
sure.
He didn't say
that. I mean, yeah.
Hemingway also said it took 19 drafts.
Right, and he's arguably one of the greatest writers ever. So,
well, my juniors would disagree because I made them read The Sun Also Rises.
Sun Also Rises. Is that the
That's the bullfighting
one in Spain.
James Barnes, who's been wounded. Yeah. They enjoy Bradbury too, though. I make them read 1984, Fahrenheit 451.
Right.
Bradbury. And they do love that.
Right. If they hate A Sun Also Rises, you need to have them read A Farewell to Arms and how that thing just ends.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of them get into it when it gets to the bullfighting, and they really get into it. But there are some very long sentences that sometimes confuse them. But boy, when you can get them to start to deconstruct that story, you get some great conversations.
Oh yeah,
I think the book that I read that I was like, I'll never read this author again. I think it's Daniel Cooper, Deerslayer.
Yes.
Oh my God, I threw that book in the trash after I read it and vowed never to read another one of his books. For being a classic, I was like, you have a sense that lasts, and this was a paperback edition, but you have a sense that lasts almost 3 pages. That's ridiculous. And this is classical writing. I was like, wow. So yeah, that one just kind of blew my mind. I was like, these are the masters, supposedly.
Right.
Well, Oliver Twist is great, but it's like, please, just every time he finds a clue to who he is, they lose it again. It's like, just one moment. kind of almost reminds me of Sons of Anarchy. Every time Jax was going to get out of it, you know, something blew it up right at the end. You know? Right.
A little Michael Corleone from Godfather 3. Every time you think he's out, they pull you back in.
Yeah, they pull you back in, yes.
Exactly. Yeah. But,
and that's...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So that's something else I think of with the Silver Dragon Chronicles. I was like, my heroes don't always lose, but they're not always going to win. You know, sometimes, and people don't have to die for there not to be a win, but, you know, they're not always going to be successful, and I think that's appealing too, or at least it is to a lot more readers today. They don't always want everybody to have a happy ending. It's not all fuzzy bunnies and unicorns.
Right.
With a squatty potty. No. Sorry.
But I guess you've written several screenplays and you've written several novels. Is your writing process the same for both, or does it change depending on what you're writing?
I think it changes somewhat. When I write a screenplay, I kind of follow all the nice little rules that we had to do in class, all the little assignments that we had to turn stuff in. I might spend a little bit more time researching my screenplays as far as backstories and things that are happening. I kind of want to work on one, kind of an American Jack the Ripper story, so there's a little bit more research there. Zombies, I fly a little bit more by the seat of my pants. I don't give my characters as detailed backstories as I do my Silver Dragon. You could definitely have some short stories that are the lives of some of these characters before they come into the book. But Zombies, I kind of feel like they pick up, it doesn't matter who they were before. it's a whole new, you know, the world's starting right now, and this is who they are now and how they're going to survive.
Yeah.
So I don't go into detail and backstory. I map things out. I do write the ending. I don't do a full outline. I do tell my students, I said, I know, don't get so bogged down that if you write an outline, you can't change things. And I do start off at the beginning planning so heavily, but then once I get going on the story, it just the planning sort of just goes out the window. So I think the processes are the same, but I approach the characters of the stories differently because they're different people.
Okay, that makes sense. Would you say that, like, as you're writing a novel, are you more like a Stephen King style where every single day, no matter what, a certain number of words, I think he says like 2,000 words is going on the page? Or are you more closer to, I guess, like a George R. R. Martin, who apparently just writes randomly throughout his life, because we're still waiting on Winds of Winter?
Yeah, I know. You can't leave everybody bleeding in the snow and then, you know, die.
Right.
Not the characters. I mean,
yeah, no. The actual fans.
I quote out of Stephen King's On Writing all the time, and in On Writing, he said, try to write 1,000 words a day.
Right.
I kept track for 2016. I did a spreadsheet chart, which is actually on my author Facebook page, and I tweeted it to Stephen King. Whether I get a response ever, who knows? I probably, but I did try to meet 1,000 words a day. I kept track of it every year, so I shoot for that. There were 3 0 days that year, two of them were Comic Cons. And there were 2 over 4,000 word days, and those were actually in the summer when I don't teach. But yeah, I shoot from that. I try to shoot a certain number. I thought, because I actually thought my average was about 800. It turns out my average was 1,100. But if I'm not trying to heavily edit a story, like when it's due, I try to shoot for 1,000 words a day. And if a story's bogging down, or you get what writer's block, what you'd call writer's block, you know, I've got other characters I'll go fiddle with for the day to get my words and keep writing and keep honing that craft. It's like, you know, if I wanted to be Michael Jordan, I need to go to the court and shoot baskets every day.
Right.
So if I get 50 words and they're great or whatever, I've gotten 50 words. If I've got 4,000, that's even better. But I do find my numbers go up as I get closer to the end of the book. As I get really into the story and go into the end, and the story's flowing and flowing and flowing, those numbers went up. So you could almost, if I'd actually paid attention to what story I was writing, I'm pretty sure there was about 3 weeks that was 2,000-3,000 word days, and I know that was the end of the story. I was getting so close. I wanted to get there too.
Right.
At what happened.
If you're doing a novel or a series, I always say give the first book the chance. For a novel, I always say read 100 pages, because that's the hardest one to write, or hardest part to write, before, like you said, the story picks up, because you're establishing all the characters, you're establishing all the scenes and what's happening. And so in that regard, some people, I think, disregard and just say, oh, it's not going anywhere, where it would be nice if they would take that mentality and say, let's read the first one and then start the second one and then see where it goes.
Yeah.
But in our society being so fast and loose, are you seeing, I don't know, readership has changed going to the digital?
Yes.
And have you seen it declining a little bit, or pretty much the same? Because some numbers skew different ways wherever you're reading.
Well, I don't know. Over the 17 years I've been a teacher, you just always have kids that are never going to read, no matter what. And then your kids that are readers, they'll suffer. I mean, they'll suffer through a book. I met a guy at the con who told me, he says, well, if I get through the second book, it doesn't matter if the rest of them are crappy, I'll read the rest of them. And I thought, well, I don't plan on that happening, let me just tell you right now. But the kids that read, though, they go crazy when they, and I've seen they'll fight over a series, you know, like their library will get one copy of a series and the new one will come out, and they're like, and they'll fight over who's going to read it, and then other kids don't want to read. I do see there was a trend there, kind of seemed to go more towards ebook, and now people are kind of going back to the books. But I'm working off the list, you know, 1,000 or 100 books everybody should read, and then Stephen King's list, and then my own list, you know, that I'm reading. And I wade through some of the quote-unquote classics, and I'm like, if this wasn't on the list, I'm done.
Right, yeah.
And I get it. I mean, I have a degree in literature. It's just, I understand you know, the value of some of these pieces, or you have to understand the history, what was going on in this time frame when they wrote it. I mean, Jonathan Swift is a perfect example. I mean, he couldn't speak out against the government, so we're going to make, you know, other governments in strange, weird fairy lands so we can understand it better. But sometimes I think that's the history part sometimes is hard. Why were they writing it up? We talked back to The Sun Also Rises. We talked a great deal about the fact that, you know what? If you had shell shock, you rubbed some dirt on it and you got over it.
Mm-hmm.
Where today, in less than the last decade, have we only begun to deal with PTSD.
Right.
I mean, it's been a new thing. And so that really resonates with a lot of those kids. As far as, look, back then, you just got it. Why do they drink so much? Because that was how you dealt with it.
Yep.
Got your strokes.
So when you can make those kind of connections, because I do the same thing with Fahrenheit 451. I was like, it's not TV. It's your phones. It's your Facebooks. It's all those things. I said, and then they were like, oh, yeah, I get it. Yeah. And so I think when you can make it connect like that, but, you know, I'm not going to follow these kids around the rest of their life and say, read this book because it's going to it's gonna connect to this, you know. I think you just, you know, you get people that what they're interested in. And you know, Silver Dragon has a strong female protagonist. Mm-hmm. And she is flawed. She has issues. And I think that a lot of people want to see a little bit more diversity in their stories. And they do want to see more strong, our women, you know, at least treated equal.
Right.
And I thought that was always the greatest thing. You know, I told Nichelle Nichols when I met her at a con, I said, I didn't even realize some of the problems in the world because there you are on the screen next to Captain Kirk as, you know, a kid in syndication. I'm watching that and I'm like, I didn't think anything of it.
Right.
You know, that's the greatest thing about science fiction is the world's, the issues, you know, some of these petty things we do to each other go away because there are bigger problems out there to deal with.
Mm-hmm. And books are the escape, thankfully.
Yes. So. Yes, they are. And, you know, it's they're great. You know, and of course, the big thing anymore among the kids is the Marvel movies and how they don't match up with the source material.
True. That is true.
And you get discussions there, and I have that discussion with The Walking Dead all the time. You know, this, well, what's going to happen? Well, it didn't happen that way in the comic book, or this character's not in the comic book. And so I think when there's some of those TV tie-ins or movie tie-ins, I think some of them are reading more because they're like, oh, why is this happening, or what's this doing on? And I'm kind of like, I don't need to do homework before I go see a movie.
Well, Kirkman took a unique slant where he purposely did the TV series differently because he wanted people to go back to the book and read the actual source as well. So that was his choice.
That's a great ploy. That is, you know, and it creates a lot of discussion as far as those. And when I had to write that script, I had to study the show intently. Mm-hmm. And listen to episodes over and over again to get the character's voice and what they were going on. And I had actually written a scene in which Daryl shows a couple of characters how to properly kind of chop up some wood. I'd written this scene. I'd written I forget the quote out of my line, but basically it was you got to chop it right because sometimes when you didn't have electricity, you wanted to stay warm. Well, then two seasons later, you find out that he was in that kind of household.
Right.
After Merle, and I thought, I had that down from studying and studying and studying that, and I was, you know, it's one of those vindicating moments, like, okay, I had this character pegged, mm-hmm. and we hadn't seen him develop that far yet, and so when you, and you can create those kind of discussions with your students and other people, and just in general, when you're writing.
See, my sister and I were just having this conversation the other day, because I and Jacob and I were discussing this before you came on. Anyway, we were talking about how the authors on TV shows are wanting the TV shows to have a different concept than the books. So I can see where that's coming from because, like I said, Jacob and I were just talking about the Shadowhunter series on TV, and I was telling him how I had stopped watching it for a little bit because I was not too crazy about some of the characters on there, but it was the author's decision. So
sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes not.
Sometimes, yeah, sometimes things have to be changed for other reasons. But yeah, I don't. I mean, you either wanted a straight translation, you either want to see it on the screen the way you see it in the book, and then you're never happy because they never do it right. Or why not in a series like Walking Dead, where you can take those characters and do other things with them or show other aspects. I mean, Carol's a prime example. I mean, she was dead a long time ago in the comic, and she's great.
Right.
I mean, just what they've done with her is great. I think some of the other characters are going to follow closely. I mean, they won't cut off Rick's hand because it's too expensive to cut off Rick's hand. But boy, he gets hurt all the time. Have you noticed that? Just two episodes ago, he hurt his hand again. He cut it when they were trying to deflect all the walkers from Alexander. I mean, he's always hurting his hand.
They're teasing you. That's what it is. They're teasing you.
I know. I mean, sometimes you read a story and you go, you really want to see it. I'll tell you a prime example. I keep going back to Fahrenheit 451, but I said they needed a remake. I want to see The Hound.
Yeah,
I would love to see that. I mean, if you want to justify a remake of a movie, I mean, that would be a great one to modernize a little bit with special effects as opposed to other films that they don't need to redo. I'd love to see that brought into a more modern era, because that's the one thing kids always say. It's like, we don't get to see The Hound. I'm like, not when it was filmed, no. You know, so that's something that they would really enjoy. And they're a great test audience. I really wouldn't, you know, some of them I let read some pieces of some short stories, and they're a really great test audience as to what's current and what people want. It's nice to have that captive audience and such, especially in a creative writing class when you share some of your stuff as they're sharing their stuff with you.
It's our turn to get the teacher back.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Some classes I've had over the years love it when they can find a mistake in my, and I'm like, oh, thank you. glad you caught that one, because I didn't.
Brutally honest sometimes.
Well, and you would think that with Hollywood's lack of creativity lately, I mean, they basically go back, okay, we're going to remake this, or we're going to, you think they'd go back to some of those classics, especially with their kind of freaking out towards the new president. You know, you'd go back and grab like a 1984 or a Fahrenheit 451, something that deals with great government overreach or censorship, and say, hey, we should avoid turning into this kind of society. You would think.
Yeah. And dystopias are still very popular, but yeah, I would love to see a great 1984 would make a great series.
Yeah, maybe Amazon can do that once they're done with The Man in High Castle.
I've got to watch that. I want to see it. Oh, it looks good.
Yeah.
Well, what's your future plans holding out for you? We know that No Room in Hell is going to be coming out in the latter part of 17, and you just had the second part of Silver Driving coming out in the first part of 17. Is there anything else for 17, or is that going to be pretty much it? I'm working on 18 now.
Well, I'm going to try to do about a dozen or so Comic-Cons just to get out there and share. I'm working on a standalone thriller novel involving a couple of serial killers. It's actually written, but now, you know, it's the first draft, so we discussed what we think of it. and I would like to get that rewritten once I'm doing the final polishing on the second No Room in Hell book.
Okay.
You know, cause that's got a deadline now with that release date in May. And then I'm going to turn to the serial killer novel and finish it up. So it could be the end of the year. If not, it'll be the first of next year. And then probably... a Silver Dragon story, and then another No Room in Hell.
Okay.
That's sort of my plan, but you never know. I'm working on a comic book for a graphic novel, and then I'd like to write another screenplay, but you know, I got to teach.
Somewhere in there.
I've got to go to my real job so I can, you know, or. Yeah, I got to go to my hobby, which is teaching, so I can do my real job. As far as that goes. But yeah, because I've got another screenplay idea, because I just so enjoyed going to some of those film festivals and getting, I always love recognition, but there you got to mix with other screenwriters and really get to talk to that craft. So the serial killer novel's next. I've got a couple people bugging me because they're excited about that. So that'll either be closer to the end of the year or at the first of the year. But I don't want to rush things too much. I do want some quality.
Okay. All right.
I want a good story. I want people to pick that up and go, ooh, I like this. You know, I enjoy it because I write very fast. I can write very fast, but then I got to go back and clean it up, and then, you know, just and make sure. And I find the sci-fi one takes longer and longer to write because those characters have very, very distinct voices.
Okay.
And especially since some of them are aliens or from other cultures, they talk a very certain way, and it takes longer for it to flow. Where No Room in Hell is set in Missouri, and they all talk like I do, so it just goes like that.
You get the research right out your window every day, huh?
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking with William Schlichter, and we've been visiting about No Room in Hell that we reviewed, plus his sci-fi series, Silver Dragon Chronicles. He's got some upcoming standalone novel, like he's been talking about. So, William, we appreciate you coming on and visiting with us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me, you know, and, you know, you want to renew another, renew. If you want to review another book, let me know. I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts. That was great.
We'll definitely be looking for, probably we'd look at the Silver Dragon Chronicles. I think Jacob showed an interest in that, so we might have to see if we can find the first volume on Amazon and pick that up. So we might do that one for a different flavor, because we've been doing a lot of horror novels here lately. So it'll be good to do some sci-fi novels.
Okay, yeah, that sounds great.
But do you have any social contacts that you would like to mention so everybody can keep up with?
I do. I do have an author Facebook page, BHC Press. You can see me on there. And then I have a Twitter. I think it's at WM Schlichter, SCHLICHTER. That's my Twitter as far as that goes. And, I get lots of young authors who want to talk about books, and I'm always for that and what you can offer. And I love to see what other people have. I read, you know, you're supposed to read all the time. I love to read, love to write, and see what's out there.
Very cool. Very cool of you to do that for everybody. So that's nice. Well, again, we've been visiting with William Schlichter. He's the, like I said, if you like the horror genre and the zombie novels, definitely pick up No Room in Hell, the sci-fi series that he has is the Silver Dragon Chronicles, so be sure to check that out as well. That's one of the things we're going to have to check out as well for him and get back with him and maybe have him back on and talk a little bit more. We've been having fun. We hope you've been having fun, William.
Oh, yeah, it's great. I could do this all night.
Okay. Next time we'll have to book you for a little bit longer because I know we're going to have to sneak out of here, but we hope everybody out there has been having fun listening to us. We will catch everybody on the flip side. Goodbye, everybody.
See ya.
Come along with me and don't be scared. I just want to set you free. Come on, come on, come on. You and me can make it anywhere. But for now, we can stay here for a while. Cause you know, I just want to see you smile. Where you go, you know you're not alone. I'm only one call away. I'll be there to save the day. Superman got nothing on me. I'm only one call away.
Thank you for listening to Comic Pop Library. We welcome your comments and suggestions by emailing us at admin@comicpoplibrary.com. All emails submitted become the property of Comic Pop Library and are subject for use in our show. We would also appreciate it if you would spread the word about Comic Pop Library by posting about us on Twitter, Facebook, or just tell someone about us. This podcast is not endorsed by any publisher, distributor, or studio, and it is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. The views and comments of the show hosts are their own and are not reflective in any business, entity, or organization associated with ComicPopLibrary.com.